Okay, this is session 324, still among the Mormons, the legacy of William Mulder. Let's see, I'm to remind anyone who has a noise-making device to please turn it off. Is this mic okay? A little soft? Okay, I will try to talk loudly. Everyone who speaks, everyone talk right into the mic, okay? Let me introduce the other panelists. In the order in which they will speak, I will speak first. Phyllis Barber is the author of 7 books, including Raw Edges, a second memoir forthcoming from the University of Nevada Press in fall of 2009, a novel, and The Desert Shall Blossom, her first memoir, How I Got Cultured, a Nevada memoir, which was featured on NBC's Today Show, 2 collections of short stories, and 2 juvenile books. I wish he had this. I'm right next to it. Is this louder? Okay. She has taught in the Vermont College MFA writing program for 17 years, has served on the fellowship panel for the National Endowment of the Arts, and was recently inducted into the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame. She lives in Denver, Colorado, to be near her 3 sons, their wives, and 4 fabulous grandchildren. Fred Buchanan is Professor Emeritus at the University of Utah's Graduate School of Education. Having taught at the U from 1970 to 1996, he is also Ambassador at Large of the Utah Scottish Association. He has 2 books, A Good Time Coming, Mormon Letters to Scotland, and Culture Clash and Accommodation in Public Schools in Salt Lake City, 1890 to 1990. Let's see, he and his wife live in Salt Lake City, have 5 grown sons, and today is his 77th birthday. Mary Lithgow Bradford has a master's degree in English from the University of Utah, is the author of Lowell L. Binion, Teacher, Counselor, Humanitarian, and Leaving Home, Personal Essays. 2 books. She is editor of Personal Voices, A Celebration of Dialogue, and Mormon Women Speak, and a contributor to Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poems, Tending the Garden, Essays on Mormon Literature, A Thoughtful Faith, A Little Lower Than the Angels, and A Time to Weep and A Time to Sing. She was the editor of Dialogue from 1978 to 1983, and her own articles have appeared in BYU Today, This People, The Deseret News, The Journal of Pastoral Counseling, and elsewhere. She has received awards from the Association for Mormon Letters, the Mountain West Center for Regional Studies, the Evans Award, and a recent independent scholarship grant from the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies to research and write a biography of Virginia Sorensen. She lives in Leesburg, Virginia, near one of her 3 children. Emma Lou Thane has written 13 books of poetry, fiction, essays, and travel stories. She has been widely anthologized and published internationally on kinship and peace among people and nations. She has been active in encouraging public attention to mental health, spirituality, and the advancement of women. Her words to the hymn, "Where Can I Turn for Peace?" have been translated into dozens of languages, as has her chapbook of poems about war and the environment, How Much for the Earth. She has been married to Mel Thane for more than 50 years, has 5 daughters and sons-in-law, and many grand and great-grandchildren. Emma Lou taught English and was the women's tennis coach at the University of Utah, where she was awarded an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters in 2000. The Emma Lou Thane Community Service Center is a source of great joy as it provides students and faculty at Salt Lake Community College with broad opportunities to serve. And Emma Lou has some words also from Doug Alder, who wasn't able to come, and if there is time, she will read those. William Mulder made his first Sunstone Symposium presentation 28 years ago. He began teaching at the University of Utah 51 years ago. We panelists are connected to him because of Sunstone and the university, and hope we are representative of his innumerable admirers, followers, and friends. If there is time following our remarks, we hope you will share some of your experiences and memories of him. When I lost my parents, one through death, the other through dementia, I lost my childhood. That is, I lost my role as a child to somebody, a role, of course, that I had resented during much of my adolescent and adult life, though once it was gone, I attached to it great significance and nostalgia. However, my 100-year-old mother's most real memories are of her own childhood. So if I follow her into that fuzzy night, maybe I'll regain my childhood that way. Still, I know no one now alive who guided me through my early years. I had become somewhat used to my childhoodless state, just as I became used to my own childless state. But in March, I had to adjust to a new loss. 10 days before my mother's centennial birthday, William Mulder, a mere 92 years old, died in Salt Lake City. With the death of William Mulder, I may have lost my studenthood. He was the last of my great English professors, and he was the only one with whom I maintained an affectionate relationship for over 4 decades. In the year since my 1962 graduation from the University of Utah, I visited with him no more than a dozen times. But it was with pleasure and respect that we would meet, usually at the Sunstone Symposium. He would tell me that he had read, and sometimes tell me that he had liked, my published stories. He would ask me about my writing and teaching. I read and appreciated his essays, and often felt that he was writing to me. Although he became grizzled and gray, I never saw him, but that I remembered sitting happily decades before in his undergraduate classes. It was 1960 when I first encountered Dr. Mulder. His American Literature Survey confirmed my resolution to major in English and specialize in American literature. My best friends, Nancy Folland and Teddy Wood, also English majors, sat next to me in the class. We were all fascinated by him and declared him the sexiest of our teachers, even though we regarded him as quite old. He would have been about 45, with thinning, rather wild hair. There were rumors about a faltering marriage and an exotic immersion in things Indian. For a year or two before, he had returned to Utah from a teaching Fulbright in Hyderabad. He seemed distracted in our class, but that only increased his charm. We imagined all kinds of things about his private life. I think he was the only one of my great teachers who aroused in me any sort of fantasies. He also aroused in me an enthusiasm for American literature. I loved reading Victorian novels and romantic poetry, but it was the Transcendentalists and other New Englanders who caught my imagination. After my junior year, I talked Nancy and Teddy and Linda Covey and Meg Rampton into spending at least some of the summer in Boston. We sublet an apartment in Somerville and followed the literary paths of Thoreau and Emerson and Hawthorne and Alcott, paths we guessed Dr. Mulder had walked when he was a student at Harvard. In those years, I was one of the golden girls of the English department because I could turn out cleverly constructed essays with dead figures of speech and because I never took a boring class from a boring teacher. I signed up for as many courses as possible from Jack Adamson, Kenneth Ebel, and William Mulder. They were probably flattered by my loyalty and rewarded me with A's, praise, and scholarships. I was a community college teacher for 34 years. My definition of an ideal student is someone hungry for ideas and information, someone able to make connections. Because of inspirational teachers, I was an ideal student. I was, that is, an ideal English student. I had a French minor, and though I was successful in garnering good grades in my French lit classes, I didn't have a gift for the French language. I bluffed a lot. In my senior year, stirred by Dr. Mulder's references to his experiences abroad, I applied for a Fulbright to study in France. I put together a project about which I knew far too little, and I made it to the second round, the interviews. I remember well that interview, which had been scheduled for the afternoon of my grandmother's funeral in Logan. My uncle, who needed to get to work near Price, backed me into his car after the funeral, but before the graveside prayer, and we sped south. He dropped me off at the U minutes before the appointed hour, and I was panting a little as I entered the conference room. As perhaps the most international teacher in the humanities, Dr. Mulder chaired the Fulbright Committee. He welcomed me and introduced me with glowing adjectives to the other interviewers. When one of these individuals addressed me in French, I misunderstood, faltered badly, mumbled something. I couldn't do what I'd done in my classes, write practically illegible French, which had been generously interpreted as perceptive analysis. I knew almost from the first that the interview was a failure, that I'd have to get to France on my own. Dr. Mulder, however, was kindness itself. He didn't even look as if he were ashamed of me or embarrassed for me. Most of my favorite professors at the University of Utah and at Stanford had Mormon and Utah connections, but Dr. Mulder's views and responses to Utah most closely reflected my own. Though of Dutch origin, he felt a bond with Europeans further north and east, and in Homeward to Zion, the Mormon migration from Scandinavia, he wrote of many Christensen and Fredrickson immigrants, none my own ancestors, but people quite like them. From the late 1940s through the mid-1950s, he was one of the Swearing Elders, a group of legendary Utah academics who enjoyed, he said, grappling with questions historical, theological, social, mostly relating to the church. About 10 years after the Swearing Elders disbanded, I began my own grappling with church-related issues. In his 1970 dialogue essay, Problems of the Mormon Intellectual, Dr. Mulder asserted, "When faith itself becomes unreasonable, putting too great a strain on the intellectual's credibility, he has to make the hard choice of silence or separation." Dr. Mulder chose separation of a sort. I chose silence of another sort. In my fiction, in my essays, I have tried to tell the truth, however tenuous it is. I have understood all too well what he wrote in his 1993 dialogue article, Telling Its Slant, Aiming for Truth in Contemporary Mormon Literature. This is what he said. "Although I find myself badly out of step with institutional Mormonism, often distressed to the point of anger with the conduct of the corporate church, I feel myself in tune with the Mormon experience, by which I mean the sum of Mormon history and culture as lay members have lived it and lay writers have striven to describe, critique, and celebrate it. I am drawn less to the sacred texts of Mormon theology handed down from on high than to the subtexts of writers who wring their truths from their daily pacing beneath their checkered canopy of Mormon belief, writers who cry out with that father recorded in St. Mark who sought a cure for the son wrecked by fits, 'Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief.'" Ironically, Dr. Mulder was the most Mormon of my great teachers. So much of his writing deals with the history and culture of Mormons. Many of his favorite associations were with people who shared his Mormon upbringing and his Mormon skepticism. Although he reached across geographical, cultural, economic, and religious boundaries, he reserved a place in his heart for the cloistered flock in the Utah mountains and those who, like himself, had left the fold. His continued attachment to things Mormon makes me wonder whether he really left the fold at all. And his continued influence on students and friends makes me think that, though I can no longer talk with him between or during symposium sessions, he hasn't left us even now. He remains to me a mentor who guided me in a role I cherished, that of an eager, impassioned apprentice of literature and culture and ideas.
When I heard about the panel being given to commemorate Bill Mulder and his life and his body of work, I was eager to take part. The first words that came to mind when I recalled his face and his presence were, "There was something elegant about him. This distinguished scholar and gentleman of the First Order, this man who knew the heart of literature." I remember my first encounter with him. He was teaching a class in 19th century American literature at the University of Utah in the late 70s. I'd been away from school for a fair amount of time, tending babies, but I'd tried to keep my love of literature alive in the meantime. But I remember approaching the university with some trepidation mixed with anticipation. Professor Mulder had been the director of the Institute of American Studies at the U and had an impressive background during his time at Harvard. Something about him was old school in the best way possible, a gentleman with an inquiring mind who could translate and bring to life the finest ideas created by humanity. He was the quintessential teacher, evocative, challenging, and wise. I'm glad I was able to study with him before postmodernism engulfed the teaching of literature at the university. I loved the old days before the language of semiotics became entrenched and when one could talk freely about the meaning of a text. Bill Mulder knew literature better than the back of his hand. He brought it to life, and the meaning of the text merged with him as a teacher and as a reader. His class proved to be one of the more seminal experiences of my educational life. I came away with a much deeper understanding of Edgar Allan Poe, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville, Mark Twain, and literally fell in love with Twain's Mysterious Stranger, which remains one of my favorite pieces of literature to this day. I also began to get a sense of what it meant to have an American literature, a literature that represented the sensibility of this country rather than an imitation of the European establishment. This gave me ideas about writing from the essentials of the Mormon experience and made me wonder about the differences between international, national, and regional, and about how to find the universality in each of these arenas. After that quarter at the U had ended, I often ran into Bill at literary readings or in arts theaters or arts festivals. He would always greet me warmly and with interest. Without fail, he'd comment on the most recent article I'd written for Utah Holiday or Dialogue or Sunstone. He remembered the text as if he'd read it the day before. He always had an observant, cogent remark to make. I was flattered as well as deeply honored that he took the time to read what I'd written. The second intersection with Bill Mulder. I was doing research at the Utah Historical Society to find material for a collection of short stories based on Mormon folklore. Thumbing through the files in a wooden file drawer, I found a folder left there by who else but William Mulder. It contained notes about a Scandinavian gentleman who had emigrated to Salt Lake and lost his love in the process, either through death or disinterest, I can't remember. The man went a little crazy and proceeded to decorate and redecorate his house and his fence on First South with paper cutouts and paper flowers of many colors. The name of that story, which I reworked many, many times, was Bread for Gunnar. I owe my gratitude to Bill for leaving behind the genesis of one of my favorite stories. The third intersection with Bill happened when I decided to read his epic book, Homeward to Zion, regarding the emigration of 30,000 Mormon proselytes from Scandinavia to Utah in the latter half of the 19th century. Because I'm half Danish and the other half British Empire, English and Welsh, I was fascinated to read of the way the Danes accepted the gospel and what historical events were occurring at the time. I'm going into my Minnesota accent, speaking about the Danes. I loved reading that the Danes were the first and the most predominant converts and that they were usually reluctant to sail out farther than they could row back, and that they were considered poor pioneers. This helped explain a few of my own tendencies. But these Danes had broken the mold. According to Mulder, they'd left their homeland in years of actual prosperity to become hardy settlers beyond the frontiers of where Scandinavians were settling at that time in America. I was fascinated to know that the first missionary work among the Scandinavians was in the United States, at the Fox River Colony in Illinois, Sugar Creek in Iowa, and Koshkonong in Wisconsin Territory rather than in the old country. That was news to me. And being teethed with stories of the pioneers and being sung to sleep with songs such as, "We go where nations yet will come in ships from climes abroad, to seek protection and a home and worship Israel's God." I learned more of the actual history of the migration than I'd ever known before. As I read his book, I loved reliving the movement of our forebears as they moved from what was then called the Babylon of Europe toward the pure in heart of Zion, of re-experiencing their grand hopes, of going to Denmark with Apostle Erastus Snow and Elders Peter Hansen and George P. Dykes, as they negotiated their way with the help of letters of introduction from members of the U.S. Congress, as they taught the Danes about the newly rewritten Danish Constitution, which had been reformulated only a year previous to their arrival. This allowed them to preach the gospel. Had they gone a year earlier, they would not have been welcomed or even allowed. This new constitution was unfamiliar to most commoners, so missionaries had to teach the Constitution before the Bible could be taught, and definitely before the Book of Mormon could be taught. I loved being part of these converts' initial enthusiasm as their faithfulness was channeled and shaped by Joseph Smith's teachings and by the programs evolved from these teachings. I also loved revisiting the way their fervent faith became something, quote, "more than an aimless love affair with Christ," unquote, as Mulder says so beautifully, and the way they became committed to unifying with the saints in the Great Gathering. I welcomed a new understanding of how the idea of gathering had always played a part in my own connection to the Mormon culture. I loved living inside of this idea for the duration of the book. It's a book I've never forgotten. Three things I greatly appreciate about Bill Mulder. He was a teacher who helped his students negotiate the twists and turns of literary texts and helped open their eyes to the ultimate beauty and wisdom there. He was a writer who committed more hours than anyone could ever imagine to researching and creating his own text and who left a bounteous legacy for the rest of us. He was a lifelong student of literature who reached out to others with like desires, encouraged them, and supported them along the way. Thank you, Bill, wherever you are.
How now, brown cow, grazing on the green grass? The older I get, the more gravelly my voice becomes, so I've been trying to practice some explosive enunciation. Bill Mulder was one of the most generous of educators. He extended himself to help, enlighten, and inspire those with whom he consulted. Whether it was a freshman student struggling with tense consistency, or a graduate student struggling with the focus of a master's thesis, or a colleague's recent research, he gave of himself unstintingly. I knew him in all these settings, and had the ultimate honor of sitting in on his last seminar at his home in last December. In January, where he discussed my current research on Samuel W. Richards, who was the one who organized the massive migration from Europe and Great Britain. Bill's comments were cogent and relevant only a few weeks before his passing. Never did they wander off into anecdotal irrelevancies. In the spring of 1956, 52 years ago, he was my basic communications teacher. I had left school at 15 and was now back at school at 25. And my first freshman papers were dripping with blood. Bill's comments were, in the spring of 56, he was my basic communications teacher. And one of his assignments was to make a note was for us to make an oral presentation to convince the class of something that we felt strongly about. So I chose as my focus the poetry of Robert Burns. At the conclusion of my 3-minute presentation, Bill handed me a pink slip with a succinct and focused evaluation. Still got it. So typical of Bill Mulder. A warm, sympathetic presentation of a poet you wanted us to know. Good opening for an American audience. A fine reading of his lines. Excellent control of voice. Even the pauses are eloquent. I'm not sure if he meant there when Buchanan stops, it's better than when he begins. To someone who has hated Scottish schools with a vengeance, these positive words helped dispel the notion that I was a slow learner. After all, when I graduated at 15, my headmaster, Johnny Rushton, MA, BSc, could come up with only 2 words to evaluate my 4 years of academic slavery. On my final report card, he wrote, "Well tried." William Mulder brought a deep sense of intellectual curiosity, excitement, and introspection to his teaching and his research. But his keen analytical acumen never ignored the need to have empathy for the students and for the topic. During the defense of a dissertation dealing with the intellectual development of a prominent Utah churchman and educator, one member of the committee urged the student to include more of the later and less rational aspects of the churchman's in his study. Bill responded to that suggestion that the study was not meant to be all-inclusive and that we ought to be fair and take the man at his best. Professor Mulder was ever a gentleman. William Mulder, his other admirable characteristic was his basic honesty. In an interview a few years ago, he freely acknowledged that all my life was conditioned by the Mormon experience. However, when he came to the point of seeing no place for him in the Mormon Church, he simply withdrew without making a public display. In all my contacts with him, in class and out, I never heard him be mean or cantankerous with regard to the church. He was always very uplifting. In spite of, critical, but not cantankerous. In spite of this change, he never abandoned his interest in Mormon history and culture. Indeed, almost until the day he died, he was active in thinking, writing, and conversing about Mormonism and Utah history as an interested, empathetic, and objective observer. And it was always within the context of the broader American and even international experience. Even then, he had room for local studies. To those who rejected such studies as a legitimate quest, grist for the mill, he applied the term inverted provincialism. Bill Mulder is already profoundly missed. A few lines from one of his favorite poets, Miss Emily, sum up Bill's perspective. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased, with an explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind.
Handouts, we just pass these around. Bill Mulder at Mormon History Meeting at Cedar City, sitting with his Indian friends, and a poem that I copied out of in Primavera many years ago that he wrote. I don't know if you can read it, but anyway. Yeah, I know, I'm just passing out this. In March 2008, my friend Fred Buchanan called with the news. Our mentor has left us. The light has gone out. No, I thought, the light will not go out until we stop hearing his voice in our heads. I and Fred were two of the Legion Reformer students who continued to benefit from Bill's gimlet eye long after we had graduated from his classes. Whenever I write anything, I hear his voice in my head saying, wooden and flat-footed. That's what he said when I turned in my first chapter of my thesis. Years later, he responded to one of my essays with the query, when did you become a sports enthusiast? It seemed I had inappropriate use of boxing metaphors. Fred and I and another former student, Della Chaminant, retired LDS Institute teacher and biographer, had formed a habit of taking Bill to lunch during my visit to Utah. Bill usually suggested a favorite haunt, and he usually gifted us with books from his commodious library. At a dinner celebrating his honorary doctorate at the U of U in 1999, he introduced us and thanked us for nominating him. Here are my students who have excelled me, he said. Always gracious and always the right word at the right time, like jewels placed carefully in the necklace of his perfect sentences. His writing and teaching style were aptly characterized by his colleague, Professor Ed Leaders, and I'm so glad he's here today, as always civil, always delivered with dignity and directness. He never had to search for the right word. It was always there. I knew Bill and his first family in East Mill Creek, suburb of Salt Lake City where I grew up. He lived on the street above mine. As a teenager, I admired him because he was on the staff of the Improvement Era. And I, as a teenager, I was impressed with that. I had an ambition to be on the staff of the Improvement Era. His family moved to the avenues near the university, and I was welcome there. And when they went away to India for the first time, I wrote them that I was getting married in a few months. And they wrote back. Somebody asked me if I called him Bill. I did call him Bill. He called me Missy. from a children's novel by Virginia Sorensen. He wrote me a letter, and in 19... Let's see, what year was that? Anyway, the year he went for the Fulbright, for 57. And he said, "This is precious little space in which to compress 12,000 miles over a month's adventures. But procrastination is a thief of character as well as time. And I'd better tell you that the monsoons are mild and not mildewy, that we have fraternized with the lizards and frogs in our big stone mausoleum of the house, that the index is done on my book and sent off with a million stamps to the Minnesota Press, and soon you will receive a free copy of Homeward Design." Well, I had, as a student of his, he asked me to index his next book, Among the Mormons. And that was really a wonderful experience, actually. But he advised me here to stick to creative writing involving no indexes. It's so hard to develop a style with Peterson Jens A, comma, goes on mission, period. So from then on, I kept up with him and his family as best that I could. And when Bill and Gwen divorced, and he married Helen Thompson, settled in Federal Heights, where I was also welcome. Helen always made me feel like I lived there. As a graduate student searching for a thesis subject, I submitted plans for the region of poetry based on the Book of Mormon. Well, Bruce Giesel wasn't going to have any of that. So I went to Bill instead, and he suggested if I wanted to do something creative, I could choose a creative subject like Virginia Sorensen, who was writing novels, Mormon novels, and was in the process all the time, and a good friend of his. So I was able to meet her and become her good friend. Because of her own Danish ancestry, she went got a Guggenheim Fellowship to Denmark, where she followed Bill's directions while researching ancestors from her background. The result was two novels. Bill was famous for his ability to lead his students and friends along fruitful career paths. He followed mine when I moved to Washington, D.C., and when my Bennion biography came out, he phoned me, you've hit a triple header. Now, he was not averse to sports metaphors himself. He was equally supportive of my plans for a Sorensen biography, and he brought out all his letters to her and from her, and we got together with my letter and gave a paper to the Mormon Letters meeting in Ogden in 94. I was, as a student, I basically wanted to learn how to think. I just felt that I had to learn how to think. And Bill was so good at that. He could, in a very kind way, he would point out, you know, you're wooden and flat-footed, and don't introduce something until there's something to introduce, and things like that. But his criticism was always informed by his own wide and generous reading, a mind furnished with a mental library easily accessed. The last thing he ever looked at mine before he died was my collection of poetry, supposed to come out with signature books in a minute. And he sat down with each poem, went through the whole thing. And when he got through, he said, "It's a mind at work." He couldn't have said anything more touching, because it was the mind I wanted to concentrate on. When Sun Tzu published my Why I Stay speech 2 years ago, he emailed me and said, "Its beguiling simplicity is a firm foundation for your belief. A secular humanist like me stands at the window looking in and wishing he could share your faith, but grateful for your friendship and forgiveness." When he spoke at Delmont Oswald's funeral, he closed with a quotation that I think fits him as well. Emerson said of Thoreau's premature death, "Wherever there's knowledge, wherever there's virtue, wherever there's beauty, he will find a home." Thank you.
Oh, I have enjoyed listening to my friends talk about my friend. Hasn't this been a learning experience? And they have told you a lot of things about him that I would like to say also. I'm just going to say I'm glad we heard them. I had the happy experience of sorting through notes that I kept during graduate school. Now, mind you, this was half a lifetime ago. But I'd saved my notes from William Mulder's classes. And also, in addition to those, I found in this file my mother's notes when he was a visiting lecturer at her little literary club called Cleophane. I never knew where that name came from. But these were ladies who, for long years, gave their own reports on literature. And then as they grew older, they got other people to do it. And one season, it was Bill Mulder who was there talking to them about American literature and, among other things, about Frost. And in these notes was a little pink folder with his lecture on Frost. And in my mother's calligraphy handwriting, it said, "Frost by William Mulder." It touched me deeply. But my problem was that I began scouring these notes and having so much fun reading all the things that I'd learned from Bill Mulder that it wasn't until last night that I decided maybe I better prepare for something to say today. And this morning, and then I sort of, as always, sort of got after myself last night thinking, "Emily, why do you wait until the kettle is overblowing before you start to do anything?" Anyhow, it was fun to write about him, and I've enjoyed listening today. And oh, by the way, Doug Alder, who has been down at Dixie College as president and now lives in St. George, was unable to come. He was supposed to be on the panel, and he sent me the one page of his notes that he was to talk about, and what he was to say, I left home. Well, at 83, that's a good excuse, isn't it? But I can tell you what was in it, because it was very interesting. He said that when he was composing it, he was putting together a paper on his German ancestry. He consulted with Bill Mulder about his. We've heard a lot about his history of Scandinavian people. And he said that he could not have been more helpful. Although their histories were different, he said it was he who did all of these things that people have talked about to help him be concise, be honest, be fair, be clear in what he was saying about his German ancestry. And he'll be forever grateful, because it turned out just fine, thanks to Bill Mulder. Oh, I also would like to say I talked with Helen, and she would like to have been here today, but she's in Boise at a reunion from some of her closest family, and it was a time they hadn't seen each other for years. and she felt that she really needed to be there or she would have been here. Okay, it's spring 1965. I'm 41. I've been out of school for 20 years. During those years, I've been married, had 5 daughters under 10, and taught happily but quite illegitimately as a part-time instructor of freshman English with only a BA behind my name. I'd been for those 20 years a faint colleague of the likes of Jack Adamson, Dorothy Snow, Clara Short, or Bill Mulder. When I just talked to my friend Ed Leaders, and he didn't come until the following year. When World War II had ended in 1945, the University of Utah campus grew from 2,000 students, including military platoons marching from the field house to classes across the campus, to 20,000, mostly returned servicemen on the GI Bill. I had just graduated in English at 20. Desperate department chair Dr. Sherman Neff called me with 10 others, English majors, to teach freshman English. 10 of us started in the old echoey annex in Fort Douglas, then all moved to room 210 in brand new spiffy Orson Spencer Hall. Downstairs from the third floor, book-lined offices with closed doors of the real faculty. They were mentors. They were presences. We were TAs, loving the ripe, the ripe smell of new floors, the excitement of a huge class roll of mostly older freshmen, and each other. A brash Brent kept the coffee ready. Sardonic divorcee Gwen kept us real. A blind wonder with her seeing eye dog under my desk kept us humble. We became lifetime friends. Funny and teary, we cheered together the first baby of one of us named Murty, one of several very bright graduate students encouraged to come from India by Dr. Bill Mulder upstairs. By 1965, my 5 daughters were all in school. Mel was busier than ever as a real estate broker, and it was time for a new horizon. I signed up for a class, English 117 or something, Emily Dickinson from Dr. Mulder. I'd never had him as an undergraduate. He was only 10 years older than I was, and we were pretty much contemporaries. I thought I knew poetry, had always loved it, taught the good stuff, been poet laureate to the PTA and church gatherings, but little did I expect the light that was to come on. Books and papers under his arm, he strode, his youngest blonde, half-smiling teacher, in a light blue suit, shirt and tie, his interest in us obvious from his first easy survey of the filled room. I can remember my place, 3 rows back, and feeling a bit diffident of being a student, no doubt the oldest in the room, after those 20 years as part-time teacher, but not for long. I learned to think, Mary, and to grow. Dr. Mulder refuted what Robert Frost claimed, that teaching poems reduces them to mere information. Never. We read Dickinson not only savoring the slant rhymes that changed poetry for English forever, but the puzzling insights of the isolated woman in white, the pain of a heart turned to quartz, or the audacity of a non-churchgoer to sing her own hymns with birds. I wanted nothing more than to let my head follow the magic of that introduction to learning as an adult. Later, through Dr. Mulder's urging, I quit teaching for a year and took on a master's program in creative writing. Again, now Bill taught and inspired me. I'd heard his Reynolds lecture about Mormonism and the millennialism that we've heard so much about, and knew his honesty to be like Frost's, skepticism, not cynicism, not quite optimism, but far from pessimism. As he himself had matured in his work and understanding, he taught Frost as an exploratory poet, examining tradition, employing accident, and questioning experience. Imagine such benign heresy in the head of a Mormon matriarch chairing a committee for writing lessons for the Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association and writing off the top of my head with devotion and the impulse of the moment. He also taught about the poetic impulse welling up, then the taming by metaphor, that all colors of enthusiasm pass through an idea and then need to be tamed. Oh, did I need to learn that. He taught us to flourish in our own capacities as we read and wrote for him. that he taught that all the fun's in how you say a thing or in how you read a thing. My graduate paper for that Frost class compared the contrasting forms of traditional meter and rhyme in I Could Give All to Time and controlled free verse form of Wild Grapes, as each poem holds on to love. In I Could Give All to Time, I was that woman warding off time, capital T, declaring that the things forbidden that while the customs, capital C, slept, I have crossed the safety, capital S, with, for I am there, capital T, and what I would not part with, I have kept. In Wild Grapes, I was, quote, that little boyish girl. My brother could not always leave at home. Translated, suspended from a branch by my brother saying, let go, don't you know anything, girl? Let go. Then I was pretty well reduced to a philosophy of hang and let hang. My small wrists stretching till they showed the banjo strings. At last aware that also like this little girl, I had not taken the first step in knowledge. I had not learned to let go with the hands, as still I have not learned to with the heart. Dr. Mulder relished and taught us to relish so much more than recognition of style, meter, or the right of a poet or writer to say more than one thing at a time. He trafficked in meaning and substance, not only on the page, but in what we might take from our graduate studies, kindle meaning and substance in our lives. The red ink and margins at the end of my papers or blue books was as personal and rewarding as his smile in handing it back, like spirited, illuminating, or best of all, again and again, a fine stroke of criticism as good as your tennis. Imagine a teacher knowing enough to use his own metaphor to match my out-of-classroom calling. Even his criticism was never disparaging. Like, wouldn't imagery be more apt than lush here? Nothing ever indifferent, hasty, let alone put down. Now, half a time later, after 43 more years of Bill Mulder's mentoring and friendship, I find it hard to let go with the heart. His reverence for life spilled into everything he taught or lived. As in his Steinbeck class, he said with Casey in Grapes of Wrath, all that lives is holy, and that which does not change dies. He moved with soul through compassionate adulthood to a generous and knowing old age. He never really dimmed. Fact and symbolism went together. To us on the University of Utah side of our Salt Lake Valley, our Wasatch Mountains are like Steinbeck's Gabilon Mountains to the east in the Red Pony, warm and beckoning. And like our Okers, Steinbeck's Santa Lucia's on the west might seem dark, brooding, foreboding, forbidding. But unlike when 10-year-old Jody Tiflin's friend Gitano, very old, gnarled, knotted, and hard, rides off unwanted and unmourned into those mountains to the west to die, Bill Mulder at 92, knowing that nobody who ever has a family will ever die, quietly slipped away surrounded by his very present family and alive forever in the hearts, minds, and spirits of those of us lucky enough to have felt like family in his classes and under his spell. He represents the highest quality human being in either academic or community setting. No enigmatic philosopher, but a thinker. He made the universal particular. He encouraged us to stay attuned to the balance between justice and mercy, and in any of our success, to retain the right to fail. For Bill, old age was not dismal, degrading. It was the culmination of years well spent. Like Browning, too often quoted and for so many unfortunately untrue, the last of life for which the first was made. He stayed important to others and to himself, likely ready to see that even death won't get a crumb by his mouth that he won't keep and savor. And now surely the soul of him, the gorgeous, glowing, fervent soul of him, is flaming in eager joy upon some other dawn.
we have a few minutes if any of you would like to share any of your memories or experiences with Bill Mulder. There's a mic right there, and we would love it if you would make use of that. Please.
I never had a class from Bill Mulder. I had a class from Ken Evell and Dorothy Snow and Clara Short. But Bill became a member of my doctoral committee, and I majored actually in graduate school in the School of Communication. Back in those years, I got a degree in oral interpretation. And when I was teaching oral interpretation in the speech department, which became the communication department, I was teaching interp classes, and during several quarters, Bill would call me up and say, "Would you and a few of your students in interpretation come to my Frost class and read some Frost poems for us?" And that was the memory of the experience of my students, and he didn't invite just me, he invited my students and I to come and read Robert Frost for his classes in Robert Frost, and we felt so appreciated and so valued, and the memory of those times when my students and I went to Bill Mulder's Frost, and this was probably during my master's degree years, but I was so appreciative of having him on my doctoral committee subsequently, but I always felt so valued by Bill Mulder, and always regretted that I didn't have the experience that so many of you have had to have him as an undergraduate teacher. He was of great value to my education nonetheless.
This was such a good Facebook.
You can turn the mic around so you can face other people if you want to.
I didn't have Bill Mulder as a teacher, but Jean did. And so I didn't. I only met him through Jean or some occasion that we go to. But the impact of his teaching, as I hear you describe it, carried on. And Jean would do those things. I mean, the little notations on the papers that students talk about, and the attention in the words. So I appreciate Bill Mulder without, you know, having known him near like you did. And I appreciate what he did for his students. And I, you know, of course I see it in your writings now. And how wonderful that was to have that kind of teacher.
He liked rice pudding.
Yes. he liked rice pudding, and I liked taking it to him. I was never a student of Bill Mulder's, but I got to go to tea at his house. It wasn't exactly English tea, but it was juice and biscuits, the proper kind of biscuits that they had in India. And it was because of Mary that I got to meet Bill Mulder. And they would have the most amazing conversations about everything you could imagine. But he would never, no matter whenever we visited, and I'm sure we visited once or twice a year in the summers, would he ever let me off the hook without telling him what my project was, what I was doing, and what I was going to be doing next, and how was I thinking it through, and would I come back and tell him about it. And I fell in love with him too. So I was very, very, very fortunate that I would get to tag along and get to be in that, bask in that wonderful glory of his intelligence and his charm and his amazing universal beauty. So thanks for sharing it with us.
What's your name, Bill?
My name is Vera Bell Clough.
And that was Charlotte England.
And Ron Frederickson.
They used to hear him on the TV radio.
I used to hear him in the temple.
Yes. Well, we don't mention that.
I'm Teddy Wood, and I'm a cowgirl from Idaho. Come to the big city as a freshman. Really. Grew up in Rexburg, which is a great town. Put on a huge fight against a proposal that our college, Rick's College, be moved 23 miles to Idaho Falls. And a committee of 1,000 hung a few of the instigators at the gym. They stood up because, this could go on, but in the dedicatory prayer dedicating Rick's College, the person dedicating it, a prophet, promised that college would always stay in our town, not the town of our basketball, football opponents, 23 miles away. And after many years, that turned out. But my point is, I come from a kind of a feisty little town in Idaho, but nevertheless, coming to the University of Utah as a freshman was a big shock. I mean, I got my first C grade in college, in psychology. I mean, one of his classes, because of my high school. And so running into the English department, because that's what a lot of people majored in that weren't sure they wanted to do. And Bill Mulder's hospitality, it goes to just even this level, not academic, but I remember him being the one teacher that we could go up after class, and there were about three of us, probably it was Nancy Folland who couldn't come today, and Karen and I, Karen knew, but we didn't know what he was about to help us with. He explained to us what graduate school was. Now, I mean, where's a cowgirl from Idaho going to learn what graduate school is, based on my experience? And I remember that. And he had a soft voice, and he was more than generous. And I love the word, who used it? He extended himself. And those of us who know our lives are richer whenever we extend ourselves. I don't care if it's someone helping us in the grocery store, online, or on the telephone. That hospitality is so marvelous. I think of it as a very Greek thing. And so I was really loved that. Say, well, here's somebody that taught us, although a couple of people, Jack Adamson did a wonderful thing once too. He said to, I think it might have been Betty Lou Sine. We found ourselves in his first class on poetry. Well, we had no poetry in our background. I mean, to me, a tree was a tree. And he said, could you come to my office? And so he would coach us about symbolism to get us ready. So I wanted to remember Bill for that, and a lovely, kind human being, without the arrogance for which educated people and others, the mighty, are often known. So thank you, Bill, and thank you for leaving things for us to read and savor.
We're out of time, but thank you very much for coming. The College of Humanities incidentally has left some little letters here inviting people who might be interested in participating in a project to name an office after Bill. If you want to grab one of these afterwards, we'll have them up here. Okay, thank you very much.